going to present some work we did with Do Profeta from Torino, Antonio Celani from Nice, and Grisha Falkovich from Marx Institute. And one of the aims of this work was try to answer the question whether there was conformal invariance in two geography. So that's not really a new question, for example, this question was asked by Polyakov a few years ago, but we come, I think, with a different answer from what Polyakov said at that time. And the way we try to answer this question is by looking at some curves in two determinant flow and try to analyze this curve via SLE techniques. So it's known that if you look at statistical system, well, there's many infinite number of the freedom which are interacting, and if you look at the second order phase transition, at that point there is strong fluctuations, there is macroscopic fluctuations, no characteristic lines. Well, then you have scale invariance in the system, and if the interactions are local enough, then the fault plot says that you will promote the scale invariance to conformal invariance. So that's what we know, what we expect, or what we believe for equilibrium system, which are described by Boltzmann weights, so by a Gibbs measure. So one of the questions we try to answer is whether the same phenomena will occur for systems which are out of equilibrium, like turbulence. Turbulence is one of the famous systems which are not at equilibrium because there is flux. And on the top of that, in turbulence interaction is non-local because of the pressure, for instance. So we were wondering what will remain about this factor, and whether there will be conformal invariance or not. So at the end of the lecture, we expect that at least we can see some conformal invariance at least in some sectors of two determinant systems. We don't know yet if all sectors can be described in a conformal invariant way, but at least some object that is have some conformal invariance property. but before coming to that point, I will explain a little bit the basic phenomenology about turbulence. Let me start. So turbulence is a part of fluid mechanics. So what you describe when you describe turbulence flow, you start from the Navier-Stokes equation. So you have a velocity field u, and the evolution equation is that one, which is written here. So Navier-Stokes equation. So there is a term which is advection term. That's the one here, which just says that particles in the fluid are transported along a flow line defined by the velocity field. Then you have a term which corresponds here, which is a dissipation, which corresponds to some dissipation at small scale, nu is a viscosity. So this term acts at small scale. And then in two dimensions, you have a term which is a pressure, which depends on the force due to the pressure. Then you have an extra term which is here, the force, which codes for the factor, the way you inject the energy into the system. And what we will look at is for incompressible fluid, so which means that the divergence of the velocity will be zero. And then in two dimensions, sometimes you add another term, which is here a linear term in U, which linked to the friction, because when you are two dimensions, then you may have friction, you have interaction between the fluid on the bottom of the basin in which your fluid here is, and you have some friction there. So it's this term dissipate energy.
So I thought usually you sort of have just a sticking condition and then there's some boundary layer that takes care of it. Is this somehow taking care of effectively taking into account the boundary layer?
Effectively it takes to account the you have a thin layer on the between the fluid that you analyze on the bottom of the
dissipation of energy in the boundary layer is taking care of this.
Okay. But this term acts more or less at all scale, and this one acts at small scale. And then what we look, usually one way to analyze turbulence is to look at the statistical turbulence. So we will make the first random, which will correspond to the way that you different way of injecting energy. So everything will be random here, because the force is random, and usually we take it Gaussian whiteness in time. So the term here is the question is very non-local, because the pressure, you can eliminate the pressure by using the fact that the velocity is incompressible, but then you have a non-local interaction. So another way to describe the fluid is when you introduce the vorticity, which is just the rotational fluid, then this will kill the the pressure term, and the equation is the one written here. That is still the term which corresponds to the advection, which means that just the vorticity is transported by the fluid. And then we have a term which corresponds to the dissipation, which will dissipate the vorticity at small scale. You have a friction term on a force which tells you the way you inject vortices into the systems. So that's the basic equation to do. What happens that in two dimensions, it's a bit special because all the moments of the vorticity are conserved. If you neglect the dissipation, neglect the friction, or neglect the forces, so you neglect more or less all the terms. So if you just keep into account the advection term, which tells you that the vorticity is transported by the fluid, then all moments of the vorticity are conserved. And especially when we are interested in two conserved quantities, one is simply the two quadratic quantities, because that's the one which are important turbulence. One is the enthalpy, which is simply the square, the density is the square of the vorticity. Another one, which is just the energy, which is the density simply the square of the velocity. So if you neglect forcing, viscosity, and friction, then these quantities are conserved in time. Now, if you have a random forcing, what we would be interested in is the stationary measure for the system, and at finite viscosity, you will reach the stationary measure after a long enough time. And in the stationary state, you will have a balance between the way you inject the energy, which is coded by the force, so the amount of energy injected by unity of time is simply the scalar product between the force and the velocity, and a balance between the injection and the dissipation, which is given by this term, and the dissipation rate is simply the viscosity times the square of the gradient of the velocity. And in stationary states, the energy is conserved, and you have a balance between the two terms. So when you look at fully developed turbulence, you look at the limit where the Reynolds number goes to infinity, so the Reynolds number is the dimensional number which characterizes the fluid. When it's very small, the fluid motion are lamellar, and then when it increases, become more and more turbulent, the fluid develop turbulence corresponds to the limit when the Reynolds number is infinite. So if you keep all the external parameters fixed, this is the same thing as taking the viscosity going to zero, but this is a singular limit. So turbulence will be characterized by the way the scale at which you inject the energy. So this means that the scale where you move, if you are in your bath, you move your hand in the bath. That's the size of your movement will give you the scale at which you inject the energy. That's actually LF. And then, as I said, there is dissipation at small scale. And what happens to the turbulence, which is completely opposite to what happened in 3D turbulence, is that there is no dissipation of energy at small scale because the velocity fluid is regular enough, which is not too three-dimensional, but there is dissipation of enthalpy at small scale. And because there is no dissipation of energy at small scale, this implies that the energy cannot flow towards the small scale, it has to flow to the large scale. And as a consequence, there is two cascades in two dimensions, and one cascade towards the large scale, which is a cascade of energy. It means that the energy you inject is transferred to the larger scale of the problem. And there is this one is called the inverse cascade. There is a display here. And then there is another cascade, which is an enthalpy cascade, where the enthalpy you inject at the scale LF flow towards the small scale, the smaller scale at which scale. Go, which is the dissipation scale, it's the scale at which the enthalpy dissipated. So that's called the direct cascade. It's called the direct cascade because usually in three dimensions the cascade is towards the small scale and not towards the large scale, but in three dimensions what's cascade towards the small scale is the energy and not the enthalpy. So there is two inertial range to domain.
So if you, this friction term was we remove it, this inverse cascade goes indefinitely? So
yeah,
no,
the energy will increase. So the energy is not dissipated at small scale. So if you don't have a mechanism to absorb the energy, then it will increase.
You have to include it.
Yeah. So it means that it will go to the mode with the smallest momenta, and it will condense at there. Then it will be absorbed by the wall of your domain. That's why you put the friction. Okay, so there is two inertia range domain, two domain where you have this cascade of conserved quantities. The one is for the GRS cascade, and I say it's between the injection length and the small length, which is the dissipation length. And there you have you expect that the naive scaling argument, which just comes from the fact that you want a constant flux of entropy in this domain, tell you that the velocity field at a scale L will be linear in L. So it means that velocity field is more or less smooth. That's why you don't have energy dissipation. But this, we know that there should be correction to that scaling, even without friction. And we know also that in presence of friction, the scaling exponent depends on the friction coefficient. This is a cascade, so which is take place in small scale of the system. And there is a cascade, which is the domain above the injection length, where the scaling is where there is a flux of energy, and when you demand that there is a constant flux of energy, you find the scaling of the velocity. And the scaling is the same as in three dimensions, the same as what's called the Kolmogorov scaling, which tells you that the third power of the velocity is linear in L. So that's this thing. What is the folklore is that there is no anomalous dimension in this cascade. So, of course, in turbulence, nothing is proved except there is these two. You can find exact statement for the correlation function of the three-point function of the velocity, and that's the only exact statement you can find in prove in turbulence. The rest is purely numerics. So what's usually the way to code this picture is by looking at the spectra of energy. This is two domains, and you find that the spectra, so at low momenta, which correspond to the initial range, scale like k to the power minus 5 of 3, that's the Kolmogorov scaling. And then you find the spectrum of energy in the direct cascade at small scale like k minus 3. Your scaling argument, and that's called the Kraken spectrum, because this double cascade was predicted by Kraken in the mid-60s. So that's the picture. And what we will analyze is the cascade in the large, the inverse cascade. So we look at large scale compared to the injection lengths. So most of the work, as I said, there is no exact statement, because it's very difficult to analyze an anisotropic equation because it's a nonlinear equation. So most of the work which we have done is based on numerics, and all the numerics have been done by Guido Boffet and Antonio Celani, so that's more or less all what I'm going to explain is their work. First I have to check that doing numerics you really see the cascade. So the numerics is done, you have the data for the numerics, so it's more or less box is of size 1, and the injection length is at is 1/10 of the size of the box. So it gives you inertial range between order of magnitude. And then you compute, you run the numerics, and then you compute the energy spectrum on the Lovelock plot, and you see that really you find here the Kolmogorov spectrum, saying that k. That the energy scale like k to the minus 4 over 3. So at least in the numeric, you see this picture of cascade of energy towards a large scale. And if you look at what you get when you look at the picture, you get this kind of picture where here what is drawn in different colors are various vorticity clusters. It means that what we call vorticity clusters are the set of points. A set of points where the vorticity has a given sign, so either it's positive or negative. I think the color when they are positive, and the black colors when they are negative. So you have a huge set of vortices, and what we will look at is that the isoline of vorticities. It means that we will look at the isoline in this domain, where the vorticity vanishes. So they are the border of the clusters between the plus and minus, whether it's positive or negative. When we look at large isoline, because we want to look at isoline which play a role in the inverse cascade, which is something which takes place at large scale. Because the set was the set of points where the vorticity vanishes is at the fractal dimension 2, so it feels so for that we extract so from that picture we extract big clusters. So again the cluster is just set of points. The domain was the vorticity as a given sign. So here is a picture of a cluster. So there is violet part is just a set of the cluster, and the dark part in between is the hole which are inside the cluster, because inside the cluster there could be also a cluster of positive vorticity, there is sub cluster of negative vortices, and also exactly like in spin model, inside Ising spin clusters with plus signs, there is clusters of spin with minus signs. So that's the kind of cluster you get. And the boundary of these clusters are lines where the vorticity vanishes. And since we, to come back to the inverse cascade, since we look at the inverse cascade, so the inverse cascade takes place between the injection lines and the some macroscopic lines, which can be, which is the size of the box, forget about the friction. But it means that the injection lines play the role of ultraviolet cutoff. If you want to make an analogy with a statistical model or Ising model, L, the injection lines will be the analog of the lattice cutoff, that is mesh of the lattice on which you define your lattice model. Which is not true in the direct cascade, because in the direct cascade, the ultraviolet cutoff is the dissipation lines, and the injection lines is the macroscopic scale. So that's why what we look at is a scenario which is totally different from what three dimensions. So again, so we have these clusters, and we look at the boundary of these clusters, and we, which are isoline, what's the isoline, and we know that the ultraviolet cutoff is the injection line. So when you extract the boundary of the cluster, you get the green line here, which is really wavy, and which makes fjords, almost fjords, like exactly in a statistical system when you look at clusters, and fjords are the domain where the isoline, the isoline is like that, and then this is the domain of the clusters. It makes a fjord where you have, you don't have really double points, but you have points which are closed at a distance a few times the injection lines. So from that we can define the exterior perimeter where we close all the fjords. So the exterior perimeter will be that was a green line. And the exterior perimeter will be this line here. And we close all the fjords. Mm-hmm. So so we have two set of lines, the two perimeters on the exterior perimeter, which is a perimeter that effective parameter if you have a large boat in the fluid, because you cannot get into the the boat is larger than the injection lines, you will be able to get into the fjord. And then we we analyze the fractal dimension of this curve. So here are the data, and here is a naive scaling argument for the fractal dimension of this curve. And the argument is as follows. You have the curve here. Of the macroscopic size, typically it's L. When you look at the integral of omega in the domain, and because if you just want to do scaling argument, the only thing you can write for this formula is that this is typically equal to the value of the vorticity at scale L times the surface, which is L squared. But in the we are in the direct cascade, and we know that the velocity scale, like from Logarov at 9, vorticity scale L to the minus 2/3, because it's one derivative of L. So this means that this will scale like L to the 4/3. But by Stokes theorem, this is the same thing as if you go over U along the curve. But then we imagine that we divide the curve in tiny box, each outside LF. And we sum the, which will cover the curve. So the number of blocks will be NLF, and the number of blocks to cover the curve. And then for each box, the contribution will be the value of the velocity at scale LF and times LF. And each box are more or less independent because LF is the size of the vorticity, the local vorticity. So that vorticity U fixed plus, we have vorticity plus here, and then the vorticity minus, and plus, and minus. So the velocity here is, so the velocity is here that way, here it's on that way. That's minus, and this velocity of the curve is here. And you have all these tiny segments, you add up them, and then you find the circulation, which is LF times U. LF times LF, and you LF scale of that form, and what you find is that the number of blocks to cover the system from this equation will be simply L over LF to the power 1. So the current number of scaling, the scaling which comes from this scaling just comes from demanding that you have a constant flux of energy, tell you that the fractal dimension of the perimeter should be 4 over 3. So when we do a box counting starting from the numerical data, we effectively find this dimension for the exterior perimeters. But if we compute the fractal dimension by box counting for the two perimeters of the cluster, we find 7 over 4. So this means that the argument I just present is not very well, not so good, because it doesn't predict the right dimension. It predicts the dimension for the exterior perimeter, but not for the perimeter. But this number is quite a magic number, because they appear in percolation. That's the dimension. If you look at percolation, you look at critical percolation two dimension, you look at the critical cluster, then the fractal dimension of the boundary of the critical clusters is given by SLS6, it's 7 over 4. If you look at the boundary exterior perimeters of these clusters, this is the same thing as the exterior perimeter of the SLS6 hull. So it's given by SLE with the dual value of kappa, so it's SLE8/3, so its dimension is 4/3. So even without referring to SLE, these are data which are well known for percolation, predicted. So we find that at least for the fractal dimension, these vorticity clusters behave in the same way as clusters in critical percolation. But critical percolation is a static model that is known at equilibrium, and here we are looking at non-equilibrium system, and so on. Even we check also the number of double points. The number of double points is the number where we close the fjord. That would be a double point in the continuous limit when LF goes to 0. So we look at the number of double points, so this from a set which has a fractal dimension less than 1, and we numerically by box counting we find 3 over 4, which is also what is predicted from conformal field theory or SLE and so on. For the number of double points in cluster of critical percolation. So this data seems to indicate, at least if you just look at the fractal dimensions of the clusters of vorticity are critical percolation. So we did more tests to test if really there was a connection with critical percolation. So we compute, we look at statistical property of this cluster, we look at the distribution. One of the two things we look at the distribution of clusters of in function of their size. And there was a prediction, this probability distribution scale. The scaling as a function of S, and the scaling exponent was predicted from percolation, and we find that they agree. If you do it numerically, the agreement is quite not too bad. Even so, we look at the distribution of the length of these clusters, and there was also prediction from conformal field theory, and this seems to act. So this seems to indicate that, again, it confirms, it goes in the way that this critical clusters of vorticity are statistically equivalent to clusters of critical pair collisions. So then, to really check in one step the conformal inverse property, we try to map them, this curve, to SLEs, and if there is really a mapping to SLEs, this would imply at once that we have the conformal property. So we try to do that. So what we do is that we throw lines in between the samples, and we extract from that, we can, this line cross the clusters, from that we extract curves which are simply on the upper half plane because they are above the line. So this give us a trace for each realization. So we extract the contour, then we cut this trace into conformal maps. Actually, and reconstruct the, and then we analyze this curve using Loebner techniques. Since we have numerical data, we don't have a continuous curve, we use a discrete version of the Loebner equation. And the discrete version of the Loebner equation consists of iterating conformal map. So we have a set of points. What we have is a set of, when you describe the curve, we have a set of points. Yeah. So first we approximate the curve by a plane slit here. So we have a conformal map which may erase this curve, which I call G1, and then so this map is a tiny slit, this map real axis. And this gives us two parameters, which I call A and B, which are related to the time difference in Loebner and the position of the driving source. Then this point here has been moved, so to some other position. And then we start again, we have another map, G2, and we iterate the process.
I think in some numerical aspects there's some advantage of using this.
Doesn't matter much.
No.
Actually, more or less, it's irrelevant the kind of tiny conformal tiny slit you use.
Uh-huh.
You can use because you see when you write this equation, so the conformal map which will erase the curve to n steps, so n points, will be the composition of n conformal map. And to see that you reproduce the Loebner equation, you just what you do, you have to just do it. This conformal map is close to the identity because the point here is close to the real axis. So this conformal map will be written of the form z plus something with a simple point which depends on the position here. So since you are doing
so
find the Loebner equation,
driving function here will be piecewise constant.
What?
Driving function psi of t will be piecewise constant.
Yeah, but if you do
instead of a continuous function, which could be obtained.
If I choose this conformal map, the function psi of t will be of this form.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's for if I use a map which
right.
Uniformly is this.
Right.
If I use that one,
right.
As you said, this corresponds to psi of t, which is a square root. So then the psi of t will be of this form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it doesn't solve. Just fluctuation around the main. okay. So then, so what you get from the analysis set of you reconstruct the well, so you get a sampling of your driving Loebner driving terms at some time, which are random also, but you interpolate between them. So you construct a curve, and then you have to analyze the curve. So that's what you get. You get the driving source, you get a set of curves, and you analyze them. So we did a few statistics on them. So first we check that the covariance xi of t is linear in time, as it should for Loebner, because we choose parameterization such as the Hoare time is exactly the Loebner time, it's a capacity. Then we check also at the full probability distribution of xi of t, we find that it's Gaussian. We should have done more tests. It's true that this is not enough to check that really xi of t is a Boolean motion. We should have checked that there is really independent increments, but we believe there are. And then this, with, by computing the value of kappa, because it, again, T is the same as in Lerner equation, with the same normalization, so the value of the covariance divided by T gives you the value of kappa in SLE, we find that it's very close to 6. So doing this numeric, we find really that the loop are locally like SLE 6. So if you push it a bit more, this analyzing, particularly by showing that CT is very has really independent increment, this will imply that you have conformal imbalance at once for all statistics of this group.
Did you check out kurtosis? Third moments?
But we find that it's very close to the PDF.
Yes.
We should we check the PDF.
Third moment.
But if this one is symmetric, I think it implies that the third moment is.
Hard to see.
Can it be can make them bigger? I don't know. But again, what is the numerics we are done by Buffett and Selen and just here as a consultant? Okay, so it seems that okay, that's where we see it. Then we did a bit more tests again because we are not never sure. More than these tests means more we are less we are sure about what we are doing. So that's with more tests, we check that Cardis crossing formula was work well. So here is the blue dot. So we just in the sample we just draw a rectangle and we check the probability for having crossing from one side to another side of the. Of the rectangle, this is was predicted by Cardi, proved by Smirnov. So here, the blue are the numerical data, and the black is the prediction. We find that it is very well. We check also that's prediction for Schramm formulas, which give you probability that the curve passes to the right or the left, I don't remember, to the right at a given point. So it fits, the numerical data fits well with the prediction. We check also the what's the Dubeda formula, which is a probability that a cluster in a rectangle, a cluster touch the four side of the rectangle, and everything seems to fit well. So really, all the tests we can do seems to indicate that there is this cluster have conformal property and are close to those of circulation. But then there was some critics. People make some critics.
I mean, you could do the same numerical thing for the exterior perimeter to see whether that is necessarily a third. Have you done that or not?
No, because more or less implicitly, the way we extract the curve implicitly assume locality because we just.
Sorry?
The way we extract the curve is that we have loops. And from loops, we want to extract curves. So we just draw lines and then follow the curves. And so we don't care so much about what happens far away. And I think implicitly this is autoconsistent because there is locality. Otherwise, I'm not sure it would be consistent.
Mm-hmm. No, so I'm not sure I understand the plane. So you have this blue line over there. Blue line, right?
Yeah.
Not the red one.
We didn't do.
And
the statistics that way.
Why?
We will do it. But as I said, the way we extract the curve, I think we more or less make the assumption that what is far, the boundary of the domain doesn't matter. So we, as soon as we have not explored, so it's more or less we assume locality.
There's also the distribution of the smaller and intermediate scale clusters that you could look at. And there should be percolation predictions for that.
But we should not look at too much smaller scale.
Not terribly small. I mean, you have to be above this dissipation length.
No. Yeah, but no. If you are between the dissipation lines and the injection lines,
mm-hmm.
the picture is totally different.
Yeah.
As I said, there is two cascades. There is the entropy cascade, the energy cascade. And the behavior of the velocity and the entropy are not the same. I will show you in picture.
I understand that, but I'm saying that, for example, inside this large line, you have smaller ones.
Yeah, we can look at, this is only statistic of simple cluster. We can look at, for example, there is prediction now for if you have many clusters. So you said
yes.
One here on this.
Yes.
Okay, you have many clusters. You have prediction for correlation for the statistic of the radius of these clusters.
Mm-hmm. For example.
That would be to go one step further, do analysis of the statistic of multiple loops. We thought about it. But there was one critique about that work made by the referee report, which says that it's really easy to find percolation. You just look at random functions. If they are short forms correlated, so they take Gaussian random function with zero mean, if the covariance is short forms correlated, then the zero line will behave like percolation. So that's what could happen. We just have used stupid machinery to produce random functions, the vorticity, the stupid machinery just not use stokes. But at the end, what we just analyzed is random functions. So we did some tests on that. First, there is a criteria which tell you how short range functions should be for this to apply. That's called a risk criteria. It means that the correlation of the random function should decay fast enough to some power law which I don't remember. Minus three half. So if the correlation decreases faster than minus three half, that you have in you know that the zero line will be in the university class of critical percolation. So this is not true for vorticity because as I told you, the scaling argument for vorticity tells you that the vorticity scale like L to the minus two third, so the correlation function, two point correlation function will scale will decrease like with an exponent minus four third. So the RS criteria does not apply to vorticity. So what could happen is that the RS criteria will apply to the sign of the vorticity, and since we have a cluster of given size, that will be enough. So we check the correlation function of the sign of the vorticity, and they decrease more or less the same way as the vorticity, so RS criteria does not also apply to the sign of the vorticity. So this means that something clearly happened, that we have we are beyond the RS criteria, but nevertheless, we find percolation. And there was another thing that we checked, another check that we did just to, because this probably indicates that the fact that the distribution of the vorticity is not Gaussian has some consequence. There is some cooperative phenomenon which tell you that even so we do not satisfy the RS criteria, we find critical percolation. So we did another modification, we take the vorticity, but then we add random phase to. So this doesn't change the scaling of the function, but changes completely the statistic. That's in Fourier component. We decompose it, and then we put a random phase in front of each of the Fourier components. This doesn't change the two-point function, but it changes the distribution of the curve, we change the distribution of the clusters. And we did the same construction, but then we find that the covariance of the driving source is not linear in time. So it's not an essay. So just this to mean that maybe it's an accident that is this conformal invariance property in turbulence, but it's a very strange accident because it passed some test which gives the most obvious criticism. But to be frank, we still don't really understand why there is this percolation.
So vorticity is known to be not a Gaussian field, right?
Yeah, sure.
So you have three-point functions and so on, non-trivial three-point functions and stuff. Is it true?
Yes. What is known exactly is that there is three-point function for a mixture between vorticity and two vorticity and one velocity field.
But three vorticity is not.
You don't have exact formula, but
yeah, but numerically,
I don't know. It's very difficult to check.
The
simplest check.
If there was a simple check that this is a non-Gaussian field, then it would be answering that criticism, right?
Yeah. But no, because the ice criteria may also apply for non-Gaussian. Mm-hmm. So then, to check if it really was an accident or not, we look at the bar. How much? When is supposed to be?
You have about 10 minutes.
We look at the variant of the Navier-Stokes equation, which is class of MODAC which is used in turbulence on, I don't know, meteorology, which is called the surface quasi-geo something. So it's again a transport equation like in 2D turbulence where you transport the vorticity. So here is the advection term, here is the dissipation, friction, and then injection. But you change, so it's a non-linear transport because the scalar is depend on the velocity which transports the scalar. But it's a violent in the Navier-Stokes in the sense that the relation between the scalar and the velocity is not the same. So the Navier-Stokes equation on here you look at incompressible fluid, so it means that the velocity is how do you call it? This star.
It's a curl. I mean it's curl.
Star D of of function psi, which is called the string function. And in Navier-Stokes, the Laplacian of the string function is the vorticity, because vorticity was the rotational loop. So you have the relation Navier-Stokes, which is that if in Fourier mode, that the Fourier mode of psi is k to the minus 2 of the Fourier mode of the vorticity. So here we change the scaling relation with the parameter alpha. So alpha equal 2 is the vorticity. So then the picture is the same, we have conserved quantity, blah blah blah, we have two conserved quantities, the energy which is T psi, that will be the energy in Navier-Stokes, the entropy which will be T squared in Navier-Stokes. There is two cascades, at least for alpha positive, there is two cascades, energy towards the large scale, entropy towards the small scale, and you have naive scaling argument, in the inverse cascade, you have the scaling argument, which depends on alpha. So you have a one parameter family. So we are looking at this one parameter family, but here I will just present the result for alpha equal 1, numerical result, to check if we still have conformal invariance in this. So for alpha equal 1, the scalar field as exponent 0 means that the naive scale logarithmically. Let's look at it.
And this h can be of either sign?
Excuse me?
The h can be of either sign.
Yeah.
Happy to have h positive or negative?
Yeah. Probably in a Navier-Stokes, it's negative exponent. Because in Navier-Stokes, T is the vorticity. And it scales with the length with the negative. Even I am happy to have alpha positive negative. But then the picture changes. So here it's T with alpha positive. For alpha equal 1, T has logarithmic correction, we check that's the picture.
What's called passive scalar with respond to alpha equals 0?
No, passive scalar is another problem. It's when you look at transport, but there is
no connection.
It's a linear problem. It means that the velocity is independent of the scalar. Okay. It's a non-linear problem because of velocity is the scalar. There's a back relation. So we check that scaling is effective logarithm. There is a logarithmic scaling for the two-point function, that the PDF are not Gaussian, but a priori there is no anomaly scaling. And then we look at vorticity isoline of T, and we same way we extract the isoline, we analyze and we look at the clusters formed by surrounded by these isolines, so the cluster where the scalar is positive. And we analyze the statistics. So there is many ways to analyze them. So for instance, we can look at the way the length of the isoline, the perimeter varies as a function of the values. When you find a scaling exponent which is 3/2, which gives you that the fractal dimension of these curves now is 3/2 for these clusters. But then you can look also how the distribution of the cluster as a function of their mass, of their length, of the radius, area, and so on. You get scaling exponent, and they all numerically coincide with prediction from conformal field theory. For the O2 model, it means for a conformal field theory with central channel C equal 1. For Navier-Stokes, which was a question to alpha equal 2, that numerical parametrization, we had correspondence with the percolation with the conformal field theory with central channel. Equal 0. So it means that there is when alpha varies, we see that we have always, at least for when we look at these loops, we have conformal property, and that the conformal field theory which corresponds to these loops depend on alpha. the correlation between alpha and central charge?
We may guess, because there is a guess that you can do, because if you know the scaling exponent of t, you have, at least in some domain, for the scaling exponent, there is a relation between the scaling exponent and the dimension of the curve. And since we know the dimension of the curve in terms of kappa, we have a relation between the exponent and kappa, and then between the exponent and central charge. Mm-hmm. That's all. This is just probably numerology. But this is how we predicted before doing the computation that we should find sigma. So then we did the same thing as we did for percolation. We extract the curve. Then we extract the clusters, and we draw a line which pass by the middle of the center of mass of the cluster. Then we have curve which go from one point to another point. That's called an SLE, but from x0 to x infinity. And we analyze them using discrete map. And then we reconstruct C of t, and we look at the PDF. So it's less clear than for percolation, for Fourier Stokes, but again, it seems that it's linear in t with a value of kappa which is close to 4, with a PDF which is close to Gaussian. Again, we should have checked the fact that the increments are independent, but we didn't do it. But we expect that will be true because we have also checked of conformal invariance.
So, which point of the O2 line do you think of? There's a critical line.
No, this is the KT point.
Maybe x, y, but then if you want.
Yeah.
So which
T equal one.
Yes, that's it. Isn't it a continuous critical line?
No, no, no.
The
exponent.
What are
you
going to say for when you
look
at the radius of compactification with the
I see. Yeah, but still, I mean, so.
You never change, whatever you do. If you do the marginal perturbation, you don't change the measure for the curve.
But surely turbulence should have exponents.
Huh?
Turbulence should have physical exponents. I mean, I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of this. You're saying all the properties of turbulence are encoded in one number?
No, no. I think that.
In all the scaling.
I said that. At least we seem to have seen some conformal invariance in some sector of turbulence. But we don't know everything. There's many exponents, but you know that.
I see, you're taking the limit C goes to 1 of SLE. That's what you call O2. Because you say it's in the same universality class as O2 model. I understand an O2 model, but that's not what you mean. You mean you take C goes to 1 in SLE, and you get some numbers.
But even if you look at conformal class theory, then you describe the line over the. Contact of operator depends on the way you describe that. You just see the many ways you don't have a field contact as a couple of pixels, but. So, yeah, of course, I don't know the field contact. I don't know if turbulence will be described by conformal field theory as a whole. If you look at bulk property, I don't know if they will be described by field theory. And then I don't know, of course, the field contact. You may get, but so okay. So that's the question. So more or less I will end here. So it seems that we have conformal invariance in some sectors for this system which are out of equilibrium. We don't know yet how to make an eight prediction, but we try time to time. For instance, we don't really understand. At least I don't really understand why it works for the inverse cascade. Except that the fact that in the picture of the inverse cascade, the injection length is the ultraviolet cutoff, so you are closer to what happens in statistical mechanics. And maybe we may also wonder for which class of non-equilibrium systems this will be. It will be possible to extend this picture. Okay, so I will stop here.